It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
In the end, his speeches had grown shorter, his appearances more rare. But Fidel Castro's tone remained defiant as ever.
Socialismo o muerte?
Socialism or death. Fidel Castro loved to hate America at every political turn.
Hasta la victoria siempre.
Eliancito, la patria te espera.
His own political stock, albeit small, soared during the international custody fight for Elian Gonzalez.
Bingo, bingo, bingo.
When the U.S. returned his little prince, Castro called the moment a moral victory over imperialist America. The man, born Fidel Alejandro Castro Ruz in Biran, Cuba, came to power leading a ragtag band of bearded rebels to overthrow a dictator. He ended up becoming one himself. Castro stood defiantly against 10 U.S. presidents. Around the world, leftists who hated America's influence and power called Castro a hero. But for the U.S., he was the all-too-close face of the bitter Cold War. In the summer of 2006, Castro underwent surgery for intestinal bleeding and quietly ceded power to his younger brother, Raul. In February 2008, Castro announced he would no longer serve as Cuba's president and commander-in-chief, a surprising move few thought they would live to see. Though often referred to as a tyrannical dictator, millions on the impoverished island considered Castro the charismatic leader who brought education and medicine to the masses. But to America's Cuban exiles, he was forever hated, responsible for Cuba's economic ruin.
Sandy Rios with you. That was Brett Baer on Fox yesterday. We all know now that Fidel Castro has passed from this earth, but I think what Brett left out, and actually I'm hoping to spend some time on this more tomorrow than today, but I'm going to give you just a little snapshot of who Fidel Castro was. He was more than just the face of the Cold War. He was more than just someone who hated the United States. He was a cruel, evil dictator to his people. I will give you an example. On May 27th of 1966, 166 Cubans, civilians, and members of the military were executed and submitted to medical procedures of blood extraction of an average of 7 pints per person. This blood is sold to communist Vietnam at a rate of $50 per pint with a dual purpose of obtaining hard currency and contributing to the Viet Cong communist aggression. Quote, a pint of blood is equivalent to half a liter. Extracting this amount of blood from a person sentenced to death produces cerebral anemia and a state of unconsciousness and paralysis. Once the blood is extracted, the person is taken by 2 militiamen on a stretcher to the location where the execution takes place. And that's a report by the Inter-American Human Rights Commission in April of 1966. This is the kind of thing Fidel Castro did to his own people. It's the kind of thing that the father Ted Cruz could tell you about, the Cubans in Florida all over could tell you about, Cuban immigrants from, they could tell you the horrors of what it was like to be in Castro's Cuba. I remember hearing a television interview with a woman who was a doctor in Cuba who had to, on the side, be a prostitute in order to survive because the incomes were so low. There's much to say about Cuba, and I plan to say more about it tomorrow, but I just want you to know it's not just about the Cold War. It's not just about that he was some sort of a romanticized leader of the Southern Hemisphere. He was much more than that. He was cruel. And the fact that President Obama thinks he's, you know, kind of a figure to be heralded is really something that we need to understand and mark in history as a shameful moment. All right, there's a lot of things going on. You know that Barack that President-elect Donald Trump is in the process of choosing his cabinet. And one particular pick caught my eye last week, and because it was Thanksgiving, we haven't had a chance to talk about it, but it's very important to many of you listening. Let's just let Fox tell the story of who was nominated. Here it is.
President-elect Donald Trump has chosen another cabinet member, charter school advocate Betsy DeVos. She is to be education secretary. She is a politician, a businesswoman, a philanthropist, and education activist from the state of Michigan. She is also, as I mentioned, a big advocate of charter schools. So clearly, the Trump administration is willing to take on the teachers union, which generally is not a big fan of charter schools. Betsy DeVos nominated to be education secretary in the Trump administration.
All right, well, it's Betsy DeVos, by the way. And Betsy, the DeVos family is known a lot among conservatives, especially conservative Christians. I believe the DeVos family paid for the building for the Family Research Council. They are big funders to the Heritage Foundation. Betsy DeVos is the daughter of Edgar and Elsa Prince. That's the family, I think, that's funded FRC's building. I believe I've got that part right. I think it's the Prince's. And also, her in-laws are Richard and Helen DeVos, the founders of Amway. So they have a lot of money, and they spend very generously. They give their money to some very good causes, which is, you know, something to be praised. But there has been concern about Betsy DeVos, and that concern probably centers on the fact that she has been a noted, at least with the dollars that she has spent and the positions that she has held, a proponent of Common Core, even if that hasn't come out of her own personal mouth. She currently serves as the head of the Foundation of Excellence in Education, which was started by Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is one of the chief proponents of Common Core in the United States. Now, Betsy DeVos has issued a statement saying that she does not personally support Common Core, period. So this is confusing. And so I've asked someone, you've heard her before on with me. It's been a long time since I talked to Sandra Stotsky. But honestly, I have to tell you that when the whole notion of an appointment of Secretary of Education came up, I thought of Sandra and wished mightily, in fact, passed her name on, hoping that she might be the pick. I'll tell you why. She is a professor emerita in the Department of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas. She held a 21st century chair in teacher quality. You know, her resume is so long. She worked for a number of years as a research associate at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. She developed a set of standards in Massachusetts, which caused Massachusetts students to achieve amazing scores, even international standing in math and English. And I could go on and on. But Sandra was on the ground floor when Common Core was being developed. And that's the source of our conversation when we last spoke to her. She is an expert, I think you would say, in English and math both. And I've asked her to join us this morning because I'm very curious to know how she feels about the appointment of Betsy DeVos. Sandra, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Listen, it really is nice to talk to you. And I'm nominating you by proxy. I nominated you for Secretary of Education. Would you have done that?
I don't think I would ever want a full-time job in Washington, D.C. I'm well past, since I retired from University of Arkansas, I'm well past a career job in D.C. But I have told a lot of people I would be very happy to go as a part-time consultant to work out a three-year plan to shrink the U.S. Department of Education. That I would go for if the president wanted a good plan.
Well, you know what? I know somebody who knows somebody, so we'll see if we can make that happen, honestly. It would be an honor to have you there, and we would be, you're like a national treasure. Okay, now that I've said that, let's get particular here. I know that you are not a fan of Common Core. In fact, let's catch up just for a second before we launch into our discussion of Betsy DeVos. Sandra, let's kind of recap that. I remember you were on the ground floor. You were chosen to help adopt these Common Core standards, and you rebelled against what you saw. Can you tell that story?
I was on the Common Core Validation Committee, which was a special committee of under 30 people that was selected to ensure that the standards were research-based, rigorous, and that they were certainly academic and as strong as we could make them. And I refused to sign off at the end of the year I was on the committee because the standards were not internationally benchmarked. That means they were not comparable to the best that was out there. They were not research-based, and they were certainly not rigorous. They're pretty flabby standards, I must say.
You know, because I should remember this, and forgive me for not. I'll probably have to ask you repeated questions, but these standards were set by whom? Who set these standards?
They were created by people selected probably by the Gates Foundation and by the two organizations that the Gates Foundation funded to develop these standards, CCSSO, which is for the Chief School Officers, Council of Chief School Officers, and then the NGA, the National Governors Association. There were two trade organizations in Washington that agreed to develop the standards, and the Gates Foundation funded them to do it. And then between them, they somehow picked the people they wanted as writers and reviewers, and the people who came up with the initial set of college-ready standards for the high school grades. Really, nobody knows who exactly was responsible for the chief English language arts writers, David Coleman and Susan Pimentel, and for the chief mathematics standards writers, who were Jason Zimba and a professor at the University of Arizona. So we have people who were chosen to be the head writers that nobody knows why they were chosen to this day, six years later.
Sandra, as I recall, of course, the whole idea behind this is that from corporate America's perspective, and we understand this part, that we are graduating a trove of uneducated young Americans. We all agree with that. And they don't even have basic skills, and certainly immigrants don't have the basic skills. So corporate America is having trouble filling jobs and getting people that can actually do the tasks. So that was originally their interest in this, right?
That was what they claimed was their interest, and that was why a lot of governors and political leaders, departments of education, and many parents bought into it because they knew our public schools had declined over the past 50 years. People know that, and this has been very clear, that our schools are not as strong as they used to be. Yes, go ahead.
All right, so the idea was to develop, and in fact, I had a teacher challenge me about this recently, a couple of teachers actually, we have to have standards. This is a good thing because our students, there's no basis, and every school system is different, and some are just horrible. They're not learning anything. So standards are good. Would you agree with that, in that general
standards
baseline?
Standards can be good because I know what we were able to do in Massachusetts. Massachusetts, yeah. Under the authority I had when I was a senior associate commissioner in the Department of Education, developed what were considered among the best sets of standards in the country. And our students zoomed from about mid-level in the ranking of states on a national report card test, the NAEP exams, and it zoomed up to first place, and it even managed to do that in science in grade 8 on an international test when we entered as a separate country. So we knew we had good standards. Yes, good standards can be developed, and they can help to make a difference, but they're not the whole picture, and you can have poor standards developed as well as good standards, and that was the problem in a lot of states, and Common Core did not solve the problem.
All right. My guest is Dr. Sandra Stotsky. We have to take a commercial break, but when we come back now, we're going to talk about the state of Common Core now that it's been implemented in so many states, and also the selection of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. What we can expect. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
This message is provided by Liberty HealthShare. You can control your health care with Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare gives you freedom from health insurance.
You can finally make the right decisions for you and your family.
It's not insurance, it's medical cost sharing.
You can affordably control the cost of your medical expenses.
It's a group of individuals sharing the cost of health care. This is based on shared values.
You are not alone.
With Liberty HealthShare, you're part of something bigger. A group of people who care for and support one another.
Join the movement of people who share in medical costs and change the way you pay for your health care forever.
It's easy. Visit healthsharefamily.org right now. healthsharefamily.org. Enroll today.
Liberty HealthShare.
Together, we're changing health care for good. Check out healthsharefamily.org. healthsharefamily.org. Not available in Pennsylvania.
You probably heard, it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you believe something, are sincere about it, and are tolerant of others who don't share your truth. Now, that sounds good until you think about it. I don't know about you, but I don't want to go to a doctor who looks at my cancer and says, doesn't matter, take some honey. I don't want to fly with a pilot who is sincere about not believing in gravity. I can do the tolerant thing, but truth is truth. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And it matters. I'm Steve Brown. You think about that. Hey, share what you just heard with a friend. Go to youthinkaboutthat.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with this Fox News and Commentary next. Truett McConnell University is training students to love the Lord, love the Word, love the Church, and love the lost. Scripture is the foundation for everything they do. It's who they are, preparing students not just for career, but to fulfill God's high calling on their lives. Truett McConnell University offers a wide array of bachelor's programs, some online, and they also have an outstanding Master of Arts in Theology. So if you'd like to schedule a visit to Truett's campus in the North Georgia Mountains, visit truett.edu. Many of you folks are pretty upset at Penzies, the spice company. The owner sent a letter to customers accusing the Republican Party of embracing racism. Penzies operates dozens of retail outlets in 29 states. In a follow-up letter, CEO Bill Penzies doubled down on his belief that Donald Trump supporters are irredeemable deplorables. Apparently, the guy's been smoking too much oregano. So here are a few thoughts about this mess. First, Mr. Penzies has a constitutional right to call his customers a bunch of deplorable racists. But those customers have a constitutional right to take their business elsewhere. And I'm sure the good people down at Food City or Piggly Wiggly would be more than happy to sell you some red pepper flakes. You know, if Mr. Penzies only wants liberals purchasing his product, so be it. Although I've always found that variety is the spice of life. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Now, our first question, 1 + 1. Yes.
2.
Incorrect. Yes.
Multiculturalism.
Well done, Simon. Next question. What is 3 × 3? Yes?
9.
Wrong. Yes, Penelope.
Gender equality.
Very good, Penelope.
Is this a joke?
You think gender equality is a joke?
No, but isn't this a maths class?
Don't be so racist.
I just asked a question.
We don't ask questions. Questions are offensive.
That's from a movie called Education with a K. Really interesting and pretty creepy. But certainly when it comes to education, it depends on the standards, doesn't it? And Common Core was developed something like 6 years ago at the behest of the Gates Foundation to sort of establish standards that were common around the country. And it all sounded good. And teachers jumped on it. And the Republican Governors Association and Jeb Bush has made millions pushing Common Core. Well, Sandra Stotsky was part of the original group of 30 that reviewed these standards, and she felt they were substandard and actually removed herself from the process. Sandra, if you could, it's very hard, I think, I'm sure you would agree, to distill the problems with Common Core in a soundbite. But if you were tasked with doing that, what would your critique be?
For English language arts, I would simply say that they are very flabby academic standards. They basically have no content. They're empty standards. They're skills. That would be the quickest I could describe the English language arts standards that are called Common Core or given other names in various states who've changed the name to remove what they discovered was a toxic label. The math standards are simply weak in that they only go up to what mathematicians call algebra 2-like.
All right, I remember us discussing that before. All right, so these are the standards. They've been adopted by almost every state, and as I recall, the deal was under the Obama administration, schools and states could do away with No Child Left Behind, which they all hated, and we don't need to get sidetracked on that, but they could get a lot of money and do away with No Child Left Behind. If they adopted Common Core in something like 30 days, it was like no time to really look into it. And they jumped at it. Almost all of them jumped at it. Is there any way of knowing this early what the effect of those standards has been? Is it too soon to determine that, Sandra?
It really isn't too soon because they have been implemented for 3 or 4 years. And the first Common Core aligned test came out last year. And so far as we can tell, we're still in a state of decline. The gaps have even widened so that the disadvantaged students in our country are doing perhaps worse. It's hard to tell the exact differences over a 6-year period. All we have for measuring clearly that we understand would be the National Assessment of Educational Progress test, and those have so far not shown any progress in what we would consider the acid test, which would be, are more kids taking advanced math courses in high school and doing even better in college? No, we don't have any clear signs from any source that kids are doing better. The gaps are growing.
All right. So enter Betsy DeVos. I've already given a bit of her resume, but I want to circle on this one point. She, by the way, if you just tuned in, she is the new Secretary of Education appointed by President-elect Donald Trump. She currently serves as the head of the Foundation for Excellence in Education, which was started by Jeb Bush, and this was all about Common Core. And I said before, Jeb Bush himself has made millions of dollars advocating Common Core. But her statement simultaneously with her nomination was this: I do support high standards, strong accountability, and local control. When governors such as John Engler, Mike Huckabee, and Mike Pence were driving the conversation on voluntary high standards driven by a local voice, it all made sense. Have organizations that I have been a part of supported Common Core? Of course, but that's not my position. Sometimes it's not just students who need to do their homework. So she says along the way, it got turned into a federalized boondoggle. So she's saying that she personally does not support Common Core. I just want to know what your thoughts are. What are we to believe here?
We certainly should be very skeptical about what her position actually is. If a person claims they are against something, but they sit on boards that promote that something, and they've never sat on a board or done anything on behalf of whatever they claim they support or whatever their position is, then you have to wonder whether they're being truthful to the public. How can you believe someone who says she's anti-Common Core, but she's given all of her time and energy to organizations that are for Common Core?
Well, of course, people in Michigan who are anti-Common Core folk are not happy with Betsy DeVos. She's the head of the, or she has been, I don't know if she's currently the head of the RNC there. And they felt that she, well, they felt, I don't think that they just felt, it's a fact that Betsy's money and her time was spent in implementing mm-hmm. Common Core against their efforts in Michigan.
That's so right. She never joined a parent organization because she never had any children in the public schools. And the parent organization consists of people whose children, they have skin in the game. Their children are in the public schools. So they are concerned about what has been happening since the state adopted Common Core. So they find themselves in a peculiar position of being against Common Core and having someone claim she, too, is against Common Core, but she's never been on their side because she's never given money to their cause. She's stopped them or opposed them whenever they've tried to do anything to implement their own views. So it sounds to many people in Michigan who know her activities and to those of us in the rest of the country that she is saying only what she thinks President-elect Trump wants to hear, because one of the few things parents heard him say was that he was against Common Core. He thought it was a disaster, and he also wanted to close down the USED. So he then appoints someone who was pro-Common Core and who is going to ask for and support school choice through a federal agency. It is contradictory to what people say, and there are some sayings about it. Don't look at the words, look at the actions.
You know, this, of course, brings up the Governor Mike Pence, who is now the vice president-elect. And, Sandra, here's the problem, of course. Governor Pence has been, was, in his early iteration, a very strong conservative. When he got into some trials, though, later on in Indiana, many conservatives, especially Common Core opponents, were very disappointed in the final outcome of the battle over Common Core in Indiana. Can you fill in the blanks on that a little bit?
I can on the question of English language arts, because I was involved at Governor Pence's suggestion. I even spoke to him several times. He had wanted me to evaluate Common Core's, the revision of Common Core standards that Indiana had originally adopted. And I always said that I'd be happy to evaluate any new effort. I just would not evaluate Common Core again, because I had been doing that over and over publicly and had evaluated as part of the Common Core Validation Committee. The state of Indiana ended up with standards that were not only aligned to Common Core, they were written even worse. They came out looking even worse than Common Core standards, if that's possible. And Governor Pence has never been happy with my stance, because I continued to refuse to evaluate the English language arts standards because they were always basically Common Core's, missing a few commas, missing a few clauses here and there, or missing a few words that someone could then point to and say, you see, they're not identical, but they were Common Core based.
All right,
and that's our problem. We've got a vice president who favors Common Core, has never said anything about shrinking the Department of Ed, yet that was President-elect Trump's campaign stance. So what are we to make of his appointment of someone who not only is pro-Common Core, but is certainly not putting in any statements about how she would shrink the Department of Ed?
Well, I think if I had to guess, which is probably dangerous enterprise, but since I'm a talk show host, I can do that. I think the whole issue of Common Core, as you and I both know, is you know better than I, is complex. It's hard to explain. And people want, on its face, they want a common set of standards when they feel the education system here is broken. They want everybody to learn math. They want everybody to speak English. That's
what
they think.
Actually did have much better standards in many states, including Michigan. Its own math standards were better.
Yeah.
It certainly expected its own students to get beyond Algebra 2 in high school.
Yeah. So But people on its face think that this is what Common Core is doing. So I'm suspecting that a person like Donald Trump understands the overview but not the subtleties of it. And so if somebody says to them, like Mike Pence did in Indiana, oh, okay, since people hate Common Core, I'm not going to do Common Core, I'm going to do this, when it was actually Common Core, by a different name with, as you said, a few commas missing. I'm curious to know, technically speaking, did Governor Pence throw out Common Core? Did he officially throw that out and implement this other thing called Common, I don't know what, whatever it's called? Did he?
They're called Indiana standards. I don't know their exact name, but they're state standards for Indiana. He actually came out against Common Core and asked for a revision and handed it off to someone underneath him, whose name was Claire Fidian Green, because I spoke to her or emailed her on many occasions. She had an office next to his and had been a charter school advocate, and she became in charge of the revision of Indiana's adoption of Common Core standards. And working with people in the Indiana Department of Education, they came up with, according to their own report, standards that were almost completely Common Core. So he knew what was going on because the person he appointed to be in charge of the project was next door to him in the State House. He certainly knew what was going on. So you have this peculiar position of people speaking out of both sides of their mouth. By the way, this is common in the last 6 years. Parents and everyone else, including members of the Chamber of Commerce who simply don't know how to evaluate math and science standards, they have been getting cross-purpose messages from the same person. We're against Common Core, and then they get Common Core given to them. They don't know how to look at them. The media have been simply out to lunch altogether for the most part. Most reporters don't know how to evaluate math or science standards, which came from Achieve and were supposed to be aligned to Common Core's math. They don't know what to say when they're told these are rigorous academic standards, and they're told that over and over again. These are rigorous academic standards. They wouldn't know a rigorous from a flabby standard if one hit them in the face.
So it's not just in Indiana with Governor Pence. It's actually sort of gotten, this has kind of become a method where politicians, governors, whoever, education entities have sort of pacified upset parents about Common Core by saying we're against Common Core and then adopting the same thing by a different name.
That's right. This has been a very common strategy. I began because I was consulting or speaking to legislators in most states, about 35 or to 40 states, I was invited to speak to legislators who'd been left out of the act altogether. Not only were parents left out, but state legislators were, and they wanted to understand what was Common Core. Well, their state departments of education were telling them a fairy tale, basically, and they were hearing from many people that these were better standards and more rigorous standards, and they would make sure that Mississippi teachers could understand what Iowa teachers were doing by noting what kind of scores their students had on tests, because the tests would be the same. There were all kinds of rationales given out to people to follow, and how was anybody who didn't understand math or know what good English standards look like supposed to figure it out?
All right, so it's possible then that Betsy DeVos is doing the same thing with her statement, where she says she does not support Common Core, but because she is probably a likely pick by Mike Pence, and because this is the modus operandi, it could be very much a ruse.
Exactly, and especially when someone has served on Jeb Bush's Foundation for Excellence in Education board for many years, which was supported by Gates money, and everyone knows that the Gates Foundation has been giving millions and millions of dollars to not only develop but disseminate Common Core standards. And he gave money to the Fordham Institute to propagate, to give propaganda for Common Core, Jeb Bush to give propaganda for Common Core, and then Betsy DeVos. So she's against it personally.
Yeah.
So how is one to believe it when she's never done a thing against Common Core?
Well, we might believe it if they appoint Dr. Sandra Stotsky to help work on this. Then I might believe it. Sandra, listen, it's always a privilege to have your time, and I do hope that we can find a place for you. That those of us that support you can find a place for you.
This message is provided by Liberty HealthShare.
You can control your health care with Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare gives you freedom from health insurance.
You can finally make the right decisions for you and your family.
It's not insurance, it's medical cost sharing.
You can affordably control the cost of your medical expenses.
It's a group of individuals sharing the cost of health care. This is based on shared values.
You are not alone.
With Liberty HealthShare, you're part of something bigger. A group of people who care for and support one another.
Join the movement of people who share in medical costs and change the way you pay for your health care forever.
It's easy. Visit healthsharefamily.org right now. healthsharefamily.org. Enroll today.
Liberty HealthShare.
Together, we're changing health care for good. Check out healthsharefamily.org. healthsharefamily.org. Not available in Pennsylvania.
Introducing the colorful new AFA Christmas wristbands. They serve as cheerful reminders of what Christmas is all about. Get a wristband free when you visit afa.net/Christmas. And remember, when you request your free bracelet and order more, you're keeping the American Family Association in the battle to restore Christian values in America. They come in packs of 10, so order several. Stop by afa.net/Christmas today.
Nothing but truth. It's Crane Durham's Corner of the World, where hard-hitting questions are asked.
People are going to be looking for answers.
And he's heard here, only on American Family Radio.
America needs to be restored to our fundamental foundation, which benefits us all.
From economics and national security to life and marriage, you'll hear the top stories of the day. Experience nothing but truth for yourself. Weekdays at 5 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
Hey, our Holy Land tour in March is filling up. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We only go one time a year to Israel, and that's in March. And our tour leaves the 9th and gets back on the 17th. And as I say, we don't have a whole lot of space left on this tour. So if you'd like to go with us and see the Holy Land, you need to give us a call at 800-FAMILIES, option 5, and we'll send you a brochure. 800-FAMILIES with an S, option 5, and leave us your name and your address. We'll send you a brochure or go online at twholyland.com, twholyland.com. Again, we're going to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Jericho and Nazareth and the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River, all those places and much, much more. So join us on this very special tour of Israel in March.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The long-awaited demise of Cuba's Fidel Castro has contributed to a new reality in the United States, if not yet on the island. It comes as Donald Trump prepares to revisit, and it is to be profoundly hoped, to revamp myriad odious aspects of the Obama legacy. Among Barack Obama's most appalling bequests was the unconditional life support extended to the Castro regime late in his presidency. With support from the incoming Trump administration and leadership on Capitol Hill by, among others, newly re-elected Senator Marco Rubio, the stage is set for a U.S. repudiation of normalization and lessen until Havana embraces human rights, political liberalization, and sweeping economic reform. Another prerequisite should be an end to Russian and Chinese military installations in Cuba, like their signals intelligence facility at Lourdes and naval bases and military airfields that threaten the United States. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I've got an officer down in front of headquarters. I need EMS right now.
That urgent call for help came moments after San Antonio Detective Benjamin Marconi was shot. Police have released a photo of this man entering a building who they believe may have more information about the shooting.
We consider this suspect to be extremely dangerous and a clear threat to law enforcement officers and the public.
Police Chief William McManus says Detective Marconi pulled over a driver in front of police headquarters just before noon. That's when the suspect parked his vehicle behind Marconi's patrol car and approached the driver's side window where Marconi was sitting. The suspect allegedly shot Marconi twice in the head before running back to his vehicle and driving off through the headquarters south parking lot.
The fact that he did what he did to a police officer sitting in his car, tells me that he's the ultimate coward.
Marconi was pronounced dead at the hospital.
Nobody that has a bad word to say about Ben Marconi.
Police say surveillance footage captured this black sedan speeding away from the scene.
All officers be on the lookout. Use extreme caution.
Police don't believe the suspect had any relationship to the original driver who was pulled over, and so far, no motive has been identified. Omar Villafranca, CBS News, San Antonio.
And following Sunday's violence, San Antonio police officers were ordered not to attempt any traffic stops unless they were accompanied by another officer. 58 officers in the United States have been killed by gunfire while serving in the line of duty this year.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. That was a report from WBNS 10 TV. And, of course, that happened the weekend before Thanksgiving, and it wasn't the only shooting. There was an officer in St. Louis who was shot in the face twice. There was one near Kansas City who was shot during a traffic violation, and one in Sanibel, Florida. Four policemen shot last weekend. And let me just say that since Thanksgiving of 2015, 145 law enforcement officers have been killed in the line of duty. Professor John Lott, good friend, a great researcher, a beacon of light on this issue, if there is such a thing, trying to bring light to it so that we can stop it. The founder of Crime Prevention Research Center, the author of More Guns, Less Crime, and many, many other books, joins us this morning. Good morning, John. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. Great to talk to you.
You just did a report. Of course, the allegation, certainly from Black Lives Matter, is that white police officers are killing black suspects. That's the rap, that it's all about racism and white cops killing black citizens. And you did a study on this. And so I guess the question is, how in the world would you study, how would you know motive? How in the world could you study something like this?
Well, a couple of things we looked at. One of the things was to look at the rate that black police officers shoot black suspects, and to see whether or not white police officers shot black suspects at the same rate that black police officers did. And try to account for a lot of other factors that might explain the rate that either type of officer shoots them. So, for example, was the suspect armed? How was he armed, with a gun or a knife? Was he involved in the commission of a crime when he was shot? And trying to look at other things like whether body cameras affect the rate that the shootings occur. Because, you know, you listen to the Obama administration, they seem to believe, and they're putting money into trying to study this, that if you put a body camera on a police officer, it will make it so that shootings of black suspects will go down relative to that for whites. Suspects, because they feel that officers are engaged in some type of racism and that they're more likely to shoot a black suspect under the same conditions because of racism there. And if you shine a light on it, they think that it will reduce the types of shootings which are uncalled for, unjustified. So, you know, those are some of the things that we looked at. And what we find is that, in fact, black officers, if anything, are more likely consistently to shoot black suspects than white officers are. It's not always what we'd call statistically significant, but you always find that type of effect there. On things like body cameras, we find no impact from body cameras on the rate that black suspects are shot. You find other things, for example, that if you do want to try to reduce these things, one thing that we find that's very important is whether or not is the number of police officers that you have on the scene. just going from one officer patrol units to two officer patrol units reduces the rate of shootings by about 18%. So, I mean, those are some of the things we try to find and how we try to get into this issue of whether there might be intent.
You know, John, it's really hard to imagine how officers, police officers, can even function in an environment like this. And I was just thinking, as you said, you know, if two officers are in the car, there's less likely. Remember the two officers who were both, I think they were both killed. Was it in California?
In New York. Just
in New York. I mean, you know, not even that safe. I mean, this is like, and shoot, being shot in the face, this seems to be becoming common too. It is just so unbelievably animal. This is like animals unleashed. And I think Americans, I think part of the reason the election went the way it did is because Americans want law and order restored. And that goes for white and black Americans. They don't want to live in a lawless society. And yet police, I don't know if you've done, you probably know this, but police recruiting has become more difficult, hasn't it?
Sure. I mean, being a police officer is already a risky job. Obviously, the rates of shooting with police officers has gone up. The perception, surely, is that it's even a riskier job than it was to begin with. It's not surprising that, you know, it's more difficult to go and recruit people for that job than it was previously. You know, it's unfortunate that you have it so that these people who are putting their lives on the line, you know, who already have a risky job are being targeted simply because now just out of spite to go and kill them because of this false perception that somehow they're systematically being racist. And I guess I think the Obama administration blames some of the, or has to take some of the blame for that perception, the way that they've treated officers, the way that they put out studies that argue that there is, in fact, systematic racism on the part of police. I've tried to get the data that they've used in their studies to make these types of claims, but when I put in a Freedom of Information Act request, the Obama administration's response is basically, well, go sue us. And, you know, I wish I had hundreds of thousands of dollars to sue them. I think hopefully with the Trump administration, they'll go and release that data. I mean, I'll just give you one example. The Ferguson Department, they'll go and say, well, look, 67% of the population of Ferguson's black, but 76% of the people who are stopped for traffic stop violations are black. So therefore, when there's any type of disparity, the Obama administration automatically goes and argues that racism must be present there. Well, you know, one thing that's kind of left out is that there's seven cities that border Ferguson that surround it. The average population for those seven cities is 90% black. I've talked to the police chief, the former police chief there in Ferguson, and I'd had this impression anyway that one of the things they try to do is to, in some sense, export their tax burden to set up traffic stops so that it's people who live outside of Ferguson who are the ones who end up paying for the traffic tickets there. It's not racism. It's just that they want to go and have people outside the city pay for their costs. I mean, that's not unusual. And so given the high percentage of the population that's black outside there, it's not surprising that you're going to get a lot of blacks stopped. You know, the interesting thing is that it's so much less than the 90% that you have there that end up getting stopped for traffic violations. So, I mean, that's just one example, and I think the studies that they've done on Baltimore and others are equally problematic, and I just think, unfortunately, that the atmosphere that that type of really poorly done science has created the type of atmosphere that you talk about in your question.
John, I remember, well, I remember the riots of the 60s, and I remember, you know, Kill the Pigs. I remember Bernadine Dorn and William Ayers and the riots and the hatred for police. I mean, it was a horrible time in our nation, the burning of cities. Are there any stats in place about police being shot? And I know they were targeted then, but do we have any comparable stats about the brutality against them during that time as opposed to this time?
Well, it was much higher back then. I mean, the rate that police have been shot has been falling very consistently over the last 60 years or 70 years or so. It's only been in the last year that there's actually really been a reversal of that trend. So it's kind of hard to go and say this is going to be some long-term effect. But, you look over the last 60 years, there's been a consistent drop over virtually that entire period of time of police officers being shot.
Well, professional police organizations, fraternal organizations, I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe almost all of them endorsed Donald Trump, and he certainly talked about this. He talked against Black Lives Matter, whereas Mrs. Clinton, a partner with Black Lives Matter, in fact, they were supposed to be on the stage with her the night that she was going to declare her victory. Any comments from you about what you think the election of Donald Trump, what effect can it have, an effect on this trend in the way that we hope, those of us that want law and order and police to be protected?
I think it can have lots of effects. I just mentioned a minute ago that if just the atmosphere or the perception that there's systematic racism that's occurring by police officers. I mean, one of the sad things that happen is if blacks do trust police officers less than they do now and won't report crimes. I mean, if you have a crime committed against you and you just believe that the police are racist, that they'll go and not care about solving the crime that you've been the victim of, or if you think that they'll just go and arrest a black person simply because of their race and not really care about whether they actually committed the crime or not, it's not really obvious why blacks then would report crimes to the police. And if the rate that they report crimes to the police goes down, then it's less risky for criminals to go and commit crimes than it was before. And the people who are going to bear the brunt of that are going to be poor blacks who live in high crime urban areas. So one of the things that we found in our research is that, in fact, blacks have been much more likely than other racial groups to go and report crimes to police that are committed against them. Indicating to me, at least, that for law-abiding blacks who are victims of crime, the majority of them actually have had fairly favorable impressions of police. So rather than being reticent relative to other races, as you might expect if they believed that the police were racist, they're actually about 10 percentage points more likely to report violent crimes committed against them than whites are, for example.
Wasn't it black witnesses in Ferguson who really revealed what actually happened at that scene and actually went counter to the narrative, hands up, don't shoot, which was not true? It was black witnesses to that, wasn't it, that actually reported the truth about that?
Right. I mean, there was obviously forensic evidence that helped make the case, but you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, there were blacks there who were not willing to publicly go and tell the media because they were worried about the backlash that they would face from other blacks there. But when they were questioned privately by police, they told them what had happened. That in fact, Michael Brown had been charging the police officer when he was shot, that he hadn't had his hands up.
Yeah. John, we have to go. And I just want to make sure that I get in your website. It's crimeresearch.org, Crime Prevention Research Center. It's crimeresearch.org. You can get John's latest study on this whole business of whether white officers are more likely to kill black suspects. It's important. John, thank you so much. Professor John Lott, thank you for joining me, sir.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.